It's time now for another edition of the Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines and myself, Jason Spies. This week, we're being joined by Siri Nadeau with Tocqueville Asset Management.
When it's time to put the booze down.
Over the past few months, I've told you about how unbelievable Hatch coaching is. Don't just take my word for it. Listen to what Christy Huber, president of the United Way of Cass Clay, says about Hatch coaching.
I think it's a really exciting time for our young leaders today because leaders like Eric Hatch are changing the face of what it means to lead an organization or what it means to lead a brand. He's changing that. For many years, I think that the gold standard of leadership has been somebody who is very polished and has it all together or seemingly has it all together. And throughout the years, I think that we've now, especially with technology and social media, we are drawn to what's real.
To find out more about Hatch Coaching or to have Eric Hatch speak at your event or company, visit hatchcoaching.com. That's hatchcoaching.com or call 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Based in New York, outstanding. Of course, we have Professor Stephen Hines with us as well, and this is the Weekly Word, a little bit of a conversation that I like to, have every single week. It's a higher level conversation. We were just talking before we went on the air here that a lot of times this turns into a high level discussion where we might use current events as examples to really talk about the layered discussion that we have. And that's kind of setting the table a little bit too early, but Professor Hines, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Actually, it's winter in Wisconsin, as you know. They even have winter up in New York. Isn't that right, Siri?
We do.
I'd rather have Siri sort of start carving out some of his interests. Because he's an analyst, and at the end of the day, he is responsible to people who give him their money. So his number one job is helping people preserve assets and make money. So I'd rather have him go through in the energy sector exactly what he covers and his view of it and situation right now, right after the snowstorms in New York.
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, it's 30 degrees over here, and after what we've been through, it feels downright balmy, actually. You know how your body adjusts to the, single digits, and then it's 30, and you say, wow, it feels good. So it was a pleasant stroll to work today. So anyways, I've listened to some of your shows, and I totally get your enthusiasm on the shale and what it represents in terms of American freedom, entrepreneurism, innovation, and it's, the layers of how it's benefited this country, layers and layers to geopolitics is amazing. So it's amazing to see that, we see success. The same things, same sort of features, aspects of this country succeed in Silicon Valley, where wireless technology in the U.S. was considered dead, 15 years ago, because Europe went GSM, and then you see the free-for-all over here kind of just, going back to Hindu Shivaism, sort of die and then resurrect. So well, the same thing in the oil industry and gas industry, the shales, where the U.S. has been shrinking as a producer, as we all know, had been shrinking for decades, and grizzled old timers like me. That looked at the industry, basically the industry was, investors were primarily populated like value players, because you're a shrinking industry, you bought net asset value, so who industry in a shrinking industry consolidates, and we would try and find what the next consolidating might be, etc. And valuations were kind of low, and then, you know, and then this growth thing happened. It's just amazing. It's been, and you've talked, you know, a lot about all the layers of how it's benefited us, from the industrial base, cost of energy for the whole country, geopolitics, manufacturing base, and it's been the job creator for the last decade.
Exactly.
You know, that's one of, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I wrote down four things that I wanted to bring up based on what you talked about. The first one was the job creator. Stephen Moore, he's a economist, and he's on Fox News at times, and I forget his organization he's with, but Stephen Moore, he's a pretty well-known economist. He's spoken a few times at the Petroleum Council annual meetings, and a couple years ago, he had an incredible stat, which was that Texas and North Dakota were the only two states that actually, you know, made money during that like decade-long recession, and North Dakota actually and Texas took care of the other 48 states during the downturn, so to speak, in the economy. And the other thing that he mentioned on there was that the oil industry, after a decade, was the only one that had a net gain of jobs, meaning all the other startups and all the other industries, after a decade, lost jobs. And the oil and gas industry, that told me a lot. Have you come across any stats like that, or any anecdotal examples to kind of either validate what Stephen Moore was talking about, or either maybe take it a different direction than what he's talking about?
No, I mean, I've I know that just anecdotal things, just the kind of things you mentioned, that the oil and gas industry has been sort of was during the downturn, was sort of a mainstay, was the job, you know, was the job creator, and we know that it's benefited this country, you know, if, in terms of just having lower price for energy, for you to for electricity, it benefits everybody. Things like that, so it's helped. And this is not my area, you know, the macro jobs and things like that. And so I wouldn't spend much time on that. But what I would what I can talk about, what I enjoy talking about, is how this industry, as it sort of, as you have, you know, as you have the production, the transportation of the production, the benefit it has to the chemical companies down on the coastline, to the refiners where natural gas is an input, where in refining and low natural gas prices benefit them, and where, more importantly, you know, the surge in production in the United States has allowed, you know, all kinds of discounted slates over here. So, you know, so we as investors look at this whole stream and have, you know, and have enjoyed making investments all along this stream, among producers, the people that provide services to them, the transportation companies, down to the refiners and to the chemical companies. So as investors, we've had a lot of fun with this. So this is the sort of, you know, this is my sort of, we look at the industry, so we know what's going on in terms of the industry, and our perch, our perspective is, how can we make money? And basically we look at this whole stream and try and find areas where, you know, where we can make money on behalf of our clients. So that's basically my sort of, you know, perch.
And as you and I were talking yesterday, Searing, that one area that you had mentioned that you didn't know much about, again, I think, as you put it, you were skeptical about the shale revolution, and certainly in a, you know, out of the way place like North Dakota.
Yeah, actually, I, I would turn the tables a little bit and ask Jason questions, because, you know, as a value guy, as Jason, as you know, the Bakken was the first oil shale that went good, that got started. And, you know, Brigham and, oh, what are the names that were there? There was one name with a little company with like something like a bear or something like that. I forget. A various bunch of companies over there. And as I started, as a value investor, I was just caught flat-footed when growth started happening. And for the first sort of tranche of the shale of oil growth, shale oil growth, which is the Bakken, I stood on the sidelines, and I wasn't a believer. It took me a while. You know, it's been decades of looking at production shrink in this country. So when growth happened, as I pointed out before, the industry was populated by value investors, and as growth happened, we were skeptical, I was skeptical, and I stood up the Bakken, on the sideline during the Bakken first few years, and as a consequence, I have never really known the Bakken well, or known the players, or really invested in it, and it remains kind of a black spot in my understanding of the business. So, Jason's question to you: I believe the Bakken is growing again, albeit at a slow pace. And what do you know? What is the health of the Bakken? Where, at what prices? I mean, today's prices, just about any of the shales can function well. But 6 months ago, prices were were below 50. And where is the break even in the Bakken? And we are invested in some companies that have been selling the Bakken assets so that they can double down in the Permian, which I know very well. So, Jason, where do you think the Bakken stands right now? You're so close to everybody in the Bakken. And, what is the mood? Is it careful growth? I mean, the industry as a whole is being somewhat careful. The rig count hasn't matched in recent weeks. The rig count hasn't matched the upturn in prices, but we're turning the budget page of the year, so we'll see what the expectations on rig count are for 18. We don't know that yet, but what is the mood in the Bakken right now?
Well, the mood is mixed, of course. I mean, there's for the oil companies, it's no different than farming, really, at the end of the day. And there's break-even prices depend on where you are, geography. And so, the good news is, this is what I was telling people the last couple of years, is the good news is, at $30, we're still drilling 900,000 to 1 million barrels a day. And 10 years ago, we were doing 30,000 barrels. So they've figured out a way to reduce the cost. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're making money. You know this, that once the momentum stops on the work crews and a lot of these rigs, it ain't that easy to get it going again. I mean, it takes time and money. So they'll do break evens. They might even lose a little bit just in order to, come on the flip side of things. The flip side of things, I remember talking to James Volker, Whiting Petroleum, 2 years ago in May. So it had been 2 Mays ago at the Williston Petroleum Council. The Williston Basin meeting they have in Bismarck every 2 years. It's in Canada, the alternate years. And he said at that time, it was about, they made about $28 million on a well, and they had got the cost down to like $8 million. So they were making, a good $20 million on each well. So they were producing some good numbers. That's why they don't mind breaking even, and they don't, mind even losing a little bit on some wells if the prices get around 50, 60, 70 bucks. They're back in, into some good days again. They're also doing some refracking, and that is doing a very good job of being a supplement. It's being another arrow in their quiver of oil-producing activities. And, North Dakota is a little bit different because We've had core samples. Now, this is not true with Montana. So we're back with Siri Nadeau, Professor Stephen Hines, a little technical snafu. So we're back at it. The question posed was, is the Bakken going to make any money this year? And, you know, that's a good question. That's a great question. I wish I had my crystal ball. But there's some reports that the production is going to kind of have a lag, and so it's going to come down a little bit. But on the flip side, you've got the governor now issuing a challenge for 2 million barrels a day. And he's met with the oil companies, and so the state is putting the infrastructure in place and really working with the oil companies so that they can achieve that 2 million barrel a day goal. And, you know, that's in the next year or two that they want to hit that. Now, is that achievable? Well, they're putting the plan in place. Now, a lot of this is price-based. I understand that. But one of the things that Lynn Helms, who is the director for the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources, 99.99% of the information that comes out of the state comes out of his office. And one of the things him and I keep talking about is, do we got to look at rig counts differently? Meaning that the rig count numbers is not the most effective way to look at the projection of an oil field anymore. So there, I threw a couple things at you guys there. One is, if you want to talk about the rig count and if we need to reinvent and relook at that, that's a whole different discussion. But at the same time, the governor is looking at trying to create an environment so the Bakken can produce 2 million barrels a day. I don't know if that answered your question, Siren, or not, but there you go.
No, it's clearly not the rig count, because it's really footage tracked, you know, is what you need to look at, because that's you know, that's exactly what you're producing, what you frack, and you know, with the laterals have doubled, and then we're going 2 miles, sometimes 3 miles now, in laterals. So it's the number of wells is not the key. It's really footage fracked. The question is, can the Bakken, sort of the U.S. is generally considered to, the expectations right now overall is for the U.S. to grow, depending on commodity prices, of course, but, you know, in a around a band of about 1 million barrels, okay, for the next 2-3 years. And broadly speaking, the Permian is expected to contribute 80% of that. About 80% of that. So, you know, so right now the expectations of the Bakken are not that high. You know, the expectations are, broadly speaking, flattish or up, you know, single digits. So the 2 million barrels that, which would represent a doubling, is considered, would be considered by investors, you know, depending on over the next 4 or 5 years, highly unlikely. I mean, the investors generally think that the Bakken, you know, the Bakken is not as you know, as efficient a resource as a lot of what you have in the Permian. Of course, there's some in the some of these areas of the Bakken, as you were pointing out, Jason, you know, is better than others, and so. So, you know, if we have much higher oil prices, of course, you know, a broader part of the Bakken can get going. So that the general view of investors right now would say is the Bakken is going to be sort of, you know, mid-single digits, you know, as long as, you know, oil prices don't grow, as long as oil prices don't go through the roof or go through the floor. So I would say that's the perspective. So I don't know whether you know, talking to the CEOs that you know, et cetera, you know, you found recently a more enthusiasm or not? You know, I don't know. As you know, companies like Continental have increased, which is a company that's been associated with the Bakken more than any. It's Continental, and as you know, Continental's putting a lot of resources down in the mid-continent, in the scoop and stack plays, etc., down in Oklahoma. So I was just trying to sense if the recent higher prices for the commodity has energized, has brought a little more energy to the players there.
You know, I think a lot of it's, again, it's mixed. You know, you've got a kind of a slow and steady deal that's happening. And, you know, you mentioned Continental looking at some other plays, and they have. I interviewed several people from Continental about the scoop and the stack, and talked to even some of the people at Whiting. Whiting is looking at getting into other shale plays as well. They acquired Oasis. Oasis is now looking at, you know, other parts of, I want to say it was the Delaware Basin, I think, is what I saw. So, I mean, I get that. North Dakota would be one of those safe stocks, in my opinion. Here's why. When we made the news before, it was because it was $100 oil. And again, we have the private mineral rights and we have the Laird Library. So the drilling cores have been done since 1950. So the oil companies know exactly where every piece of oil is. And as they go back in with the refracts, that's how they're able to get such great production numbers, is because since the 50s, we've kept a core library. So all those geologists and scientists, they know this stuff. So that's why, I mean, it's like farming now. It's like a straight commodity price deal. And where North Dakota comes in is they have the research. And they're making a lot of money on the research. The Energy Environmental Research Center, the energy companies are putting a lot of money in there. They're doing things with coal. They're doing things with natural gas. And that's really where the investments pay off, is that long term, because there's little micro booms happening out there in coal, in natural gas. One Oak just announced $1.4 billion of an investment into the Bakken for natural gas. Until they can really start making money on the natural gas side of things, there's been rumors for 5-10 years about big natural gas cracker type plants coming in there, and it's never come to fruition because the natural gas money isn't there. But when you've got 9 different kinds of gases versus Texas's 3, the oil companies love that, but they just need to figure out how to make money on that. So there's little micro pockets. That's what I mean. Like, as the technology increases, there's going to be a steady investment, because really the Bakken has figured out how to make money in both the bull and the bear market. And that is one thing that does make it special.
I agree with you. It's a steady ship. It's a pretty steady ship. I agree with you. They know the resource that does well at lower prices, and they know what they can turn on at higher prices a little more. But it's, the band is fairly steady. It's not a very wide band, so it's a steady ship, I think. I agree with you.
Well, and the other thing is that, like the Permian and the Marcellus, this whole notion of the industrial internet, better known as the Internet of Things, I think you're seeing an upgrade, and how almost every step of the way they have better evaluation tools. So I think... But there's one other factor we haven't talked about, and those are the wild cards. What will happen in West Virginia right now? China has promised $84 billion. Lord knows, don't cast a check yet. But there is an enormous amount of talk inside of the West Virginia government right now, because they have some legal issues to deal with. They have some old-fashioned laws that say that if one person of a group of people who own land doesn't want to sell, they don't have to sell. So they have to make it more of a economic activity than sort of, I don't know what, Appalachian. They're about to sort of explode in their own way. Ohio has yet really to do much work on their own reserve. And, of course, the big one, New York.
Right. Well, New York, forget about it.
That's the overhang, you know, over this discussion right now. And we're tracking, because I track pretty closely with that debate going on out about Delaware, and I have some friends who are going to testify on behalf of the health aspects that are being overblown, and the community influence factor that's being under discussed. But it's really almost down to how much good education we get out there right now, to tell you the truth, Siri.
Well, I'd say don't hold your breath for New York, but New York State. But you know, Shell is, I believe, a go. On a cracker in Ohio, I believe, or Pennsylvania,
yes.
Close to Pittsburgh. That's a go. That's a go. That'll take some years, but that's a go. 2022, I believe. And there's a lot of NGLs in West Virginia. There's a lot of NGL, you know. There's a lot of NGL in the stream, in the wells in West Virginia. It's very, very NGL rich. So a cracker there might make sense, but you know, if somebody wants to come in and put a cracker there, that could happen. I mean, the industry really doesn't need money from outside. The industry's healthy and economic on its own, especially the crackers. The first iteration of the shales, the Chinese, the Total, and Shell in the Bakken, Shell finally ended up buying Brigham, I think, so that ended up okay probably. But the first iteration, all the foreign companies that came in, even some Indian companies, they all got their bloody noses. So we really don't, and the industry is very healthy without them. So one, the industry doesn't need this foreign capital, and two, the foreign capital is after their first experience, they're a little more leery. But still, I think they might come back, but it's not going to mean, you know, whether this revolution continues or not. That it's not going to change that.
Isn't it also true that the gas industry has matured, and now they're being asked by Wall Street and other lenders, you've got to live on your cash flow.
Yeah. That's a very interesting discussion because the background is that the oil and gas companies, the E&Ps, the service companies, and the pipelines have been poor performers in the stock market in 2017. They performed all these groups were down for the year, and as you know, the index was S&P was up 22% total return. So they've been, you know, on a relative basis, particularly vast out underperformers, and they really didn't. And we've had, particularly in the second half of the year 17, we had more constructive prices, you know, quite constructive prices, I would think, given, you know, relatively speaking, relative to what we've had over the last 2-3 years. And so there's been a lot of conjecture as to the implications of stocks underperforming, and I would say it's a mix of and it's reported widely as Wall Street telling the industry to spend within cash flow and grow responsibly so that you don't wreck, you know, the whole price scheme in the world again, et cetera, et cetera. It's reported as that, and there's some of that, but it's really the stocks underperforming and then people trying to really find reasons why they did. So, and there could be other reasons, such as the indexes were doing so well, people just, I think some investors just got tired of investing in this industry. That might be a factor too. But so right now the theme that people carry is that Wall Street has told industry to go responsibly, and the industry is responding. But I take that with a big, I still take that with a big grain of salt. Because, as we all know, the industry has historically you know, always kind of, you know, outspend its capital. And I think we might be in a different path, slightly different path. At least that's what I'm hearing from the companies. But still, you know, I reserve final judgment on this. And a lot of this is on this talk of why exactly the industry is underperformed and what it means. It's you know, a lot of this is, as I said, is I think conjecture right now. But we will see the plans. We will see the budgets for 18, and that'll tell us a lot. That'll tell us quite a bit. One thing is sure is if your stock prices, you know, for the industry leaders such as the pipeline companies, the service companies, and the E&Ps, if your stock prices are not doing well, it does mean something to them. It might not be Wall Street telling them or whatever it is, but if your stock price is not doing well, you do behave a little differently. So there will be some different behavior, but that's going back to what I said before. I take this with a grain of salt. If the stock prices, on the other hand, start performing well, the industry might just go back to some of their old habits. So that's, you know, push the pedal on growth.
Hey, I got a question for you here. Siri Nadu with us, as well as Professor Stephen Hines. You mentioned something about the stock price, so I had to jump in, and we can get back to talking about the oil and gas. But I think this is actually pretty important, because I've said this for a couple of years now, being embedded in the oil and gas industry is public relations and image and ensuring that education is done to the average citizen really is important to the stock price. Do you find any credence behind that statement, or do you disagree with that?
I think the industry's done a horrible job, you know, educating the country in how important it has been to the country. You know, Aubrey McClendon, you know, I mean, before he died, he was one of the proponents that we need to sell ourselves, you know, better. And as we've talked about at the start of the show, the industry's been, the industry's benefited this country in amazing number of layers, you know, from lower electricity prices for everybody that you know, from the consumer to the manufacturer benefits them, balance of payments, and then manufacturing renaissance, exporting oil, surging exports and refined products. You know, we've got the best steel, refining steel in the world. On the Gulf Coast. And they have a chance to really show their colors, right? We're exporting propane to China, to the chemical, so it's been amazing. And not to forget about, you know, undercut and the geopolitical, you know, balance of payments, geopolitical considerations, you know, undercutting, you know, what could be a stronger Russia, you know, they had, and being able to deal with the Middle East a little more dispassionately, you know, we're not over a barrel anymore, you know. So it's amazing. Industry has not sold that message.
You know, really, that's really what Jason and I sort of, I guess that's what brought us together, because we both agree. Jason's a great, one of the things he's best at is humanizing the story and bringing it home and making people aware of the community benefits and, you know, sort of boots on the ground from the inside out. And I'm more of an activist kind of guy, but I look at what's been done. For example, now I don't mean to pick on GE. GE at one time owned 10% of the company. I helped go public, if you remember that far back. But I dealt with GE, you know, well up the food chain, renewables and things like that. But somehow they got lost. They started out with Eco Imagination in 2003, and they never used it. they have missed, you know, 15 years of opportunities to highlight what they're doing to their customers. How can you do that? You tell the world how many, you know, how many greenhouse gases have been reduced. What is it? What's that?
Right.
You know, the old-fashioned stuff.
The United States has led the world, in, as you've talked about, in a carbon reduction.
Exactly.
And it was because of, you know, it was not because of policy. It was because as a result of American innovation, the shale gas.
Well,
so you know,
including our competitiveness as far. I mean, the rest of the world is catching up as far as paying wages. So that part is sort of taking care of itself. But the truth is, we have been able to cut significantly into our cost of goods. You know,
yes.
from the steel mills on down.
Yes, that's actually in some pockets back.
Why isn't anybody talking about that? There are so many gaps in what the media is talking about. The last program we had, we were talking about the national media, and I said, no, it's the National Enquirer. You know, they have really become,
right.
The Post and the Times, they really have, even the sports section is politicized.
It was, there's about, Exxon's got two and announced a third cracker. Dow has a couple, I think, involved in a couple, and there's others. So there's at least half a dozen that are just ethylene crackers to take advantage of NGLs, cheap NGLs. Crackers, $3 billion plants are being built, so we can make ethylene, which is the base ingredient for most plastics. Now, these crackers. I think before this series of crackers, there was I don't think any had been built in the United States for about 30 years.
That's
so
correct.
It's hard. Something like that.
Yeah.
So. So it's been huge.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the Davis Refinery. Now, that is being built in North Dakota, and it's the first full-on refinery in 50 years being built in the United States. North Dakota built a diesel refinery, the Prairie Refinery, a couple of years ago, and then the original investors then sold it to, I believe, Tesoro after the oil prices dropped. But that was a diesel only, and so this Davis refinery is going to be the first full-on refinery in the last 50 years, and it's going to be next to or close to a national park, so they're being extra under the microscope on all of the emissions technology and et cetera, I got two questions for you, Siri Nadu, and what...
Is it Tesoro? Who's building? Is it Tesoro?
It's actually the Meridian Energy Group, and what it's a local family outside of Belfield, North Dakota, and they have the land and this and that, and they're working with the Meridian Energy Group. It's a bunch of energy professionals got together, I guess, kind of created a new company, if you will. They all have experience. I don't want to speak out of school for the Meridian Energy, but I believe they're within the last 5 years. Our company, but they've got wealth of experience. But
Gerald, I know that there's so little capacity over there that there's a lot of opportunity. So somebody's taking the bull by the horn and going. Do you know how big the? I doubt it's a very large refinery, but do you know what the capacity?
I don't know, 50,000 barrels a day, Jason.
Yeah. Okay. So that would be considered a mini one. That's the size of many refineries, from 50 to about 100, 110, 20 in the so-called, in pad four, as they call it, the mountain states, that's pad four. Whereas the refineries down in pad three down in the Gulf Coast are, most of them are, many of them are 500,000,
Right.
Okay, here's kind of what it is. It's a 55,000 barrel per day crude oil refinery, and they're gonna employ 200 permanent full-time people. And there is Anacortes study done by Washington State about that refinery up there. And what they found is that for every job that gets produced by a refinery, it has a 12 ripple. So the 200 jobs, they're expecting 2,400 new jobs to, you know, a community that, well, honestly, the county doesn't even have 1,000 people. And so they're going to actually go to Dickinson, North Dakota, about 23 miles away, and that's where the primary people are going to live. I would imagine where the services are, because it's on the interstate, and you know, I suppose there's probably 15,000 in people in that town. So they, you know, they've got more civilization than Belfield, who during the oil boom they went bankrupt in the 80s. So they didn't accept any growth at all. So like, I don't even think they grew one person during the big oil shale boom. And that's where a lot of the activity is, so much so they're building a refinery out there. But yeah, it's 55,000 barrels a day. From an investor standpoint, what does that mean to you?
That's why it fits. My hat's off to them. I mean, refining jobs are well-paying jobs and steady. So, you know, so it's a steady, you know, that's a great burst of positive energy to the industry, to the community.
Let me ask you this though, Sirian. Let me ask you this. Hang on, Stephen. 1 second, Sirian. From an investor's standpoint, when you hear, you know, there's a refinery coming into the Bakken, what does that mean to you as an investor? You know, I won't hold you accountable to it, but just kind of, you know, hearing that, what does that mean as an investor?
Oh, it makes sense. I mean, the refining companies I know that have assets in Wyoming or, you know, in those areas, you know, they're often 50,000 type structures, and or sometimes it's closer to a metropolitan area like, oh, I forget the city, maybe Salt Lake City or something like that, you know, or somewhere or near Denver, actually. You know, you can get up to 100, 120 or so. So there's margin opportunities for these refiners. You know, they have advantage. You know, they basically arbitrage. They can get advantage slates of crude. You know, and often they get. Historically, many of them took advantage of proximity to Canada and geared their process to take advantage of, you know, Canadian heavies, and which are, you know, as you know, trade at a discount, steep discount. But things are changing a bit. We're producing a lot of sweet crude, so this might be a more simple refine in the context of where we sit. You know, it's a very small asset, you know, so it doesn't mean much for the, it tells us more about it. It confirms that there's opportunities to make money in areas that have been neglected.
It went from 300,000 people 5 or 6 years ago to 500,000. They have been a no growth, you know, a stunted little state for more than too long for their own good. But all of a sudden, there's an optimism there, which is, I think, what being the Jason, I've been going up there for the last 3 years, and I've really bought into the story. But I suppose it's much more economic. It isn't sort of global or international news, but in some ways, there are parts of the story about North Dakota that deserve to be told to the rest of the country. For example, watching Ohio and Pennsylvania play this chicken game between the environmentalists and private sector. I mean, it's honestly, from one day to another, I mean, it will affect all kinds of things, of course, but you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, one of the stories I told during last week, I think it was, that
I read a lot. I have 45 Gmail alerts every day. So everything on emissions in the world, for example, or shale, I get. And I can at least read through and see whether I want to read it or not off the wire. But NRDC was calling on some of their people out in the Delaware Basin because they're having hearings coming up. They said to their group out there, we want you to do better presentations. We want you to wear costumes. Now, just think about that a second. I mean, you know, it really has almost become a beauty contest. And I think, you know, from my point of view, and I believe it's the same of Jason, in some ways we want to highlight the Bakken Y because it came from a long way back and it's really become a progressive state, and they are forward-looking right now.
Right. And going back to the business of it, I mean, when you have, resource creation, you have the other things happen too. Like before, you mentioned earlier that Onioke is building a pipeline there, right? So you have infrastructure coming. Now this is another extension of that. Now you have a refining asset, probably the first. Going back to your question, what is probably the significance of this, if there is one, right? It's a small asset, so from an economic point of view, there's very little significance. But the significance, if there is one, is I think it might be the first new refinery in this country in maybe 30 to 50 years. I don't know, 30 years, or 30 years at least. Because the U.S., we continue to build, expand our refining capacity, and more importantly, we continue to fine tune and invest in our refining capacity so we can more efficiently process varying types of slates. But all this activity has so far centered on existing refining iron that has existed for 30 years plus. And so there's been no sort of new greenfield refinery during, I think, in the last 30 years at least. So I think the significance of this is, it's a sort of a conceptual significance. I think, the first greenfield refinery in at least 30 years.
And remember, this is a zero emission. This is going to be state of the art. This is the kind of refinery that can be built in other parts of the world and be used as a blueprint. I mean, in some way, you know, again, that some of that has value, some doesn't. To me,
we don't have to do that. We don't need to do that. I'm the Chinese and the Indians have been, you know, building new refineries for quite a while now, and you know.
What about Africa then? Is Africa? I mean, Africa is a case all by itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Well, I tell you, I'd like to just, before we wrap up here, I'm kind of looking at the clock here, Siri Nadeau, Professor Stephen Hines, I did want to ask you about Lynn Helms, mentioned him earlier, director for the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources, interviewed him a few months ago, and he did bring up, we did talk about how the Bakken was not as sexy or advantageous or as inviting as the other shale plays right now. It's lost its competitive edge, if you will, in attracting investors. What, from your perspective as someone who deals with a lot of investors in oil and gas, and you've pretty much validated what Mr. Helm said, is that the interest is kind of weaned a little bit from the Bakken. What has to happen out in the Bakken for more interest or more investment dollars to come back in there?
Well, I mean, it's the rock. You know, it's the rock. The Bakken is, the rock is. I'm no Bakken expert, but it's the thickness is about 50 feet or so. You know, I think it varies, but it's about 50 feet or so. In the Permian, you've got 5,000 plus feet some places of productive rock. 5,000 plus feet. You know, also, you know, and so you've got, that's why in the Permian you've got that's when the Bakken, you've had Bakken was the first to really extend the laterals, because when you have thin rock, what do you just go sideways as far as you can. But in the Permian, where you have sometimes, because of the 5,000 feet of productive pay, it allows you from, depending on where you are, from 2-3 layers to maybe 7 layers of productive rock, right? So it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to compete. But on the other hand, the Permian has all kinds of, because all the rig growth that's happened so far has gone in the Permian. Right now, the Permian is suffering from, as you would expect, logistical issues. The Bakken, because of its steady state kind of level of activity, costs have remained low. Because Permian has some pressures, particularly in pumping right now. There's we're running out of pumping capacity very quickly over there. So
you don't have to import Wisconsin sand down anymore.
Oh, maybe. I think it's, they're still doing it. It's early stages of sourcing local sand. Early stages, and we'll know whether it really satisfies everybody, but and it might, we'll see. But
yeah,
it's early stages, right?
I like it from Wisconsin, so I want we want the revenue. Come on, Darren.
Who knew Wisconsin was a beach at one point? I guess it was an ocean and a beach or something like that to have such good sand.
There is the two ice ages. The second one's name is the Wisconsin Ice Age. And what it did, it brought down a bunch of fine sand down the middle of the state and went down about 150 miles. So there is this remarkable patch of sand that was left by the second ice age. Have you ever been out to Wisconsin?
I sure have. I used to love to spend time in at the what do you call that cafeteria at on the lake at university in Madison.
Oh, the terrace.
The terrace. Yeah, I spent a couple summers hanging out on the terrace. Way back.
I was just there last summer, guys. I was just up on the Mona Terrace, overlooking the lake in Madison, Wisconsin. I was just there last summer.
Still nice. The time I was there was 30 years ago, so I don't know if it's still that, but it was fun then.
And it's still fun. Just a few last thoughts. And Siri, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure and fun.
Part of what I'm doing right now, in some ways I'm trying to look at things that this country needs to learn. And I think that America has to look at things more like a utility commissioner than they ever have before. They have to understand there's a price for everything. And we have the most sophisticated grid in the world. We don't have to take it apart to make it better. All we have to do is be willing to allow some of it to be replaced with new technology, and then add it where we need it. It's not that complex.
Right. One thing we should do is, the shale should sell themselves better, like we talked before. And having listened to one of your previous broadcasts, there's a point where I disagree with you, which is I do not think it should be called unconventional. I think it should be called shales, and we should be proud of it. And
okay,
we should tell why we should be proud of it. We shouldn't be hiding behind some sort of a more obtuse word, unconventional.
I'm trying to get rid of fracking here. That's all.
I think fracking is good too. Fracking is fine. It's fine. I know it's been used as it's used as a bad word, but we should turn that around.
Well, that's good. I think that's Jason and I are both trying to do right now. We think
we shouldn't hide behind anything. We don't need to. Something to be proud of.
Siri, I totally agree with you. In fact, that's one of the things that I always brag about. In fact, it's in my business model is I don't get into the politics of oil and gas. I don't get into it. There's so much innovation going on. There is so much economic data. There is so much job growth and actual what I call good news. Because it's factual and it's not leaning in a political manner. All it is this is what's going on and this is how it's going to impact your life. Because we're talking about energy here, folks. We're talking about mining. We're talking about real life. We're not talking about whether somebody wants to use a bathroom in a gender way. Because that and you know what? And honestly, oil and gas doesn't care about that. They don't actually share a lot of those prejudices. So it's really what my biggest issue with oil and gas right now is my challenge is so much of the resources are going to the politicization of things that I think it's having a counter effect on the industry. That's why I asked you about the PR earlier, because I've noticed how politicized. You mentioned earlier, I think it was Professor Hines mentioned about how the sports page is politicized now. I do not think you need to have right to life discussions and gun control discussions when you're trying to have a factual, intelligent conversation about oil and gas. What do you guys make of that conversation I just had, or that topic I just said?
What I would say is that, you know, this industry, you know, I mean, what's important is underlines, what's the most important thing for me is underlines two key things, entrepreneurism and innovation. This is what this country is about. This is what, and that's what we should focus on. This is what, and the benefits that have come out of that. And so that's what, you know, that's what I would, you know, I would underline three times.
Siri, I laugh because I bring this up all the time that my first story I did back in 2012 when I got hooked on the shale boom, and it only took me 30 seconds because of the entrepreneur opportunities and the innovation. I mean, I looked around and I saw how many pizza joints were needed and how many haircut places were needed because there was 10,000 cars going down a road every 5 minutes. But what my first story was the shovels and picks of the Bakken, meaning back in the old gold boom days, and you know this, it was the people selling the shovels and picks that made the money. It wasn't the gold people. They made money, sure, but the guys selling the jeans and the picks and everything made the real money. So that was my first story. My second story, which I'm still revisiting on a weekly basis, in fact, I do a segment called Groundbreakers. It's called This Is Not an Oil Boom. It's a technology boom, because really that is what has been driving the growth of this industry. What do you make of that, Sirian?
And it's so American. That's what I'm trying to get back is it underlines, you know, certain core American values, and that's what we should be focusing on. It's, you know, it's just not, it's not technology as a technocrat, because there's technology all over. But what made, there's shales in Argentina, there's shales in China, but why didn't the shales over here work? It's the kind of freedom of companies just going at it, and we've created advances unlike any other because of the system. This is what we need to focus on, the system of entrepreneurism, innovation, you know, the free enterprise. You know, this is what allowed things.
Leonard Cohen has a song back from the early 90s, and one of his lines goes, democracy is coming to USA. It's got the machinery for change. And I see no other country that has figured out a way to allow enough of the machinery to work by itself.
Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to wrap her up here. So any final thoughts that either anybody might have if they want to plug their organization, their websites, or whatever final thoughts you might want to go? So, gentlemen, we'll start with Sirian Nadu. The floor is yours, sir.
Right. If you have any interest in my organization, it's Tocqueville asset management. Our website is Tocqueville.com. Our funds are TocquevilleFunds.com. And, you know, and you can find lots of good information on us through that. Thank you.
And mutual funds and individual investors, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. High net, institutional, and mutual funds.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jerry. This is Steve Hines signing off. This has been delightful. I could tell it would be... Terry and I talked a bit yesterday, and I knew it was going to be good today. So thanks for joining us, Siri.
To listen to the full-length interview with Siri Nadeau of Tocqueville Management, along with Professor Hines and myself, Jason Spies, visit thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. Of course, all these interviews are available on YouTube and Facebook Watch as well. Check out The Crude Life's Facebook page, as well as our Twitter account and other social media. Check out thecrudelife.com for all the appropriate links. Once again, that was Siri Nadeau with Tocqueville Asset Management. Professor Stephen Hines and myself, Jason Spies, would like to thank you for joining us this week on The Weekly Word.
The music on today's program is written and performed by the Moody River Band. To find out more about the Moody River Band or their music, visit our website, thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musician tab. That's thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musicians tab.
Now we're gonna have no trouble with the treble. There's no breaks in the bass. It's just you and me and baby singing in life. Old day, yeah, we're singing it like they did in the good old days, because we're back to the way. Back to the way.